Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, Barbara Kelly will be on to talk about women, happiness, and feminism. Also, Republican wives are increasingly getting ill treatment from the base, and the head of the IMF gets arrested for rape. NPR had a discussion about midwives, home births, doctors, and why you might choose what if you're an expectant mother. They started with a woman who had most of her kids at home.
Well, you notice that the first one was born in the hospital with the help of a doctor, and it just wasn't the experience I wanted. There was the threat of cesarean just hanging over me the whole time I was there, and that threat was there because of the interventions that they'd already done, including giving me an epidural, which seemed to decrease the baby's heart rate. So because of the things they did to me, the baby was in distress, and they were about to give me a cesarean. So I did manage to get him out in the nick of time, but I didn't want to go through that again.
For all the attention home births get, they are less than 1% of births overall in the nation. Last week, I did a segment looking at the continuing issue of social conservative hypocrisy with John Ensign and Newt Gingrich featuring prominently. Now it seems that there's another wrinkle in the conflict between conservative so-called family values and the realities of life. But this is playing out differently. When the men of the Republican Party preach family values to the public while cheating in private, it tends to be liberals more than conservatives who get up in arms about it, calling them hypocrites. But a new trend in politics seems to be conservatives harshly judging the wives of male Republican politicians for inadequately performing the role of the stand-by-your-man wife. The story about Arnold Schwarzenegger fathering a child with an employee and keeping it from his wife Maria Shriver for over a decade was so terrible that I expected the right-wing media to perhaps leave Shriver alone, even if they disapprove of her for being a liberal feminist. I was far too generous. Fox News responded by having so-called medical expert Keith Ablow on the show to scold Shriver for kicking her husband out of the house.
I've worked with people through things like this. I don't think infidelity should ever signal the end of a marriage simply because of the infidelity. You say till death do us part. People can get by this stuff. And she should be asking herself this question. First of all, I must have known that this guy had unusual needs for attention.
You know, even if she did know her husband was a louse when she married him, so what? Just because you make a mistake doesn't obligate you to keep making it. And to recap, he had a child with an employee that was born the very same week he and Shriver's youngest son was born. I don't think there's any way someone could predict that their husband would go that low. This treatment of Shriver tells us a lot about what Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana was up against that led him to drop out of the presidential race.
Out of politics and today's early morning announcement from Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels that he will not run for president in 2012. It leaves yet another hole to fill in the GOP field. Here with more insight is David Gregory, moderator of Meet the Press. David, good morning. Good to see you.
Hey, Lester.
Daniels dropped this after midnight, an overnight announcement. He issued a statement. In the end, I was able to resolve every competing consideration but one. The interests and wishes of my family is the most important consideration of all.
Daniels is doing more than blaming his wife for his not running. In this particular case, there's every reason to believe that his wife, Sherry Daniels, had legitimate concerns about him running for president that got in the way of her basic ability to hold her life together.
Sherry had split with Daniels years ago, then they'd reconciled and remarried, and I think, frankly, they didn't want to go through all the personal scrutiny that was coming their way.
Sherry Daniels actually divorced Mitch, married another man, divorced that man, and remarried Mitch. She was right to be worried that this would come up, as some conservative commentators were already grumbling and saying bad things about her husband because of this. Conservative writer James Taranto of the Wall Street Journal has already attacked Daniels for having an insubordinate wife, implying that the Indiana governor was emasculated by taking back a woman who left him for a time. That kind of thing can be impossible for a Republican to get over, especially one who needs the social conservative vote to get past the primaries. But there's every reason to believe that up until last weekend, Daniels fully intended to throw his hat into the ring and that he was trying to suck up to social conservatives to get there.
Mitch Daniels is trying to rectify the political problem that he's got. He is trying to reestablish his social conservative bona fides by doing something that, when you look at the rest of the country, is pretty radical. For all of the demagoguing and talking smack about Planned Parenthood and abortion rights happening on the political right this year, Mitch Daniels actually did something that no other state has done and that the federal government has not done. He blocked essentially all public funding, even federal funding, from going to any of the 28 health centers in his state that are run by Planned Parenthood. This is not blocking taxpayer funding for abortion. They already don't get taxpayer funding for abortion. What he's done is made it so that nobody in his state who is on Medicaid can go to Planned Parenthood for anything.
Since Daniels had himself declared a truce on social issues, this move was a big friggin' deal. The only way to understand it was that he was trying to warm up to social conservatives. Now he's decided that's impossible, and he's dropping out of the race. And the people who have to pay for his extended period of uncertainty are the thousands of women in Indiana who rely on federal subsidies to pay for their reproductive health care.
I'd like to welcome Barbara Kelly to the program. Barbara teaches journalism and directs the journalism emphasis at Santa Clara University and publishes as a freelance writer. She co-wrote with Shannon Kelly the book Undecided: How to Ditch the Endless Quest for Perfect and Find the Career and Life That's Right for You. Welcome to RealityCast, Barbara.
Thanks, Miyada. Happy to be here.
So let's start from the beginning. What was the impetus for writing this book?
Well, as we say in the prologue, it was booze and sweat. I had, as a professor, I had pretty close connections with my students, and I would hear back from a lot of them after graduation. And I went through this stage where it seemed like every day I was getting emails from former students talking about how unhappy they were when, you know, objectively speaking, they should have no reasons to be unhappy. They had good jobs, cool places to live, they had a great education. And I was hearing the same thing from my daughters. I have two daughters, from their friends, from my friends' daughters. And so I wrote a quick op-ed for the Christian Science Monitor that got a lot of pickup and pretty positive response. The piece was picked up in the alumni magazine of the university where I teach, and again, I got a ton of response, all of which said, you know what, you're right, that's me, I get this. And it turned out that about that time, we were having a family vacation on this little beach town just north of San Francisco, and my daughter Shannon, who's also a journalist, convinced me to go on this grueling hike one day, and while on the hike and at a bar having a beer afterwards, we were talking about this phenomenon, and she's the one that said, Mom, this has got to be a book. Let's investigate this. There's just too much going on here, and let's see if we could figure out what it is and how to explain it. And so that's how the book was born.
So you wrote the book about what you call sort of a choice paralysis that you feel women are struggling from. Can you explain what this idea is?
Yeah, I think it's something that is pretty much we interviewed at least, you know, hundreds of people, formally and informally, both women who are consider themselves undecided and experts. And what we found is this is really a new issue for women for a number of reasons. Number one, generationally, we are confronting all this illusion of unlimited options for the first time with no real role models or roadmaps for what to do. The options are there, But I think women, for the most part, haven't really learned how to deal with them or how to make the trade-off. The other thing is, I think women are both socialized and maybe even hardwired to please, and so it's harder for us to discern what we really want. One of the sources in our book, we called her Jane. She had, at one point, a great job that she said she was actually excited to get up out of bed in the morning to go to work, and then she was offered another job that was everything that she thought she wanted out of her career. Just, you know, ran down the list, the checklist, everything was good to go. And she didn't know what to do because she liked the job she had and she felt a responsibility to her boss. But then this other job was out there promising her everything. And what she said, which was so telling, was that people kept asking her, well, what do you want? And she said, I have no idea. If I knew what I wanted, I'd do it, but I don't know how to figure that out. And I think that's one of the issues, too. If the doors are open in ways that they haven't been before, but no one has really prepared us for the decision-making process or the trade-offs and the compromises that often have to be made. And I think, you know, that's kind of what the book's about. You know, there are also workplace issues, too, which are much different for women than they are for men.
There's been a lot of ink spilled on this idea of the perfect girl syndrome and the imposter syndrome, which are kind of related. That's where young women are often feeling like they, in order to be good enough, they have to be perfect or even somehow better than perfect, mm-hmm. and they have to make it look effortless. A lot of women are exhausted by all this. What advice would you give someone trying to start on the path of being less in the thrall of this notion of perfection?
I think first you have to recognize it. You have to recognize what you're up against and what the messaging has been. And I think this goes back to that whole idea of being hardwired to please. We take these ridiculous messages to heart that, oh, yes, you can do everything. You can do anything. And it has to be perfect. And I think you have to realize that nothing is perfect and let it go. And I think also when it comes to the workplace, maybe we need to get a little bit pissed off and say, you know, women are stuck in a workplace that was designed for men or women who have somebody at home to take care of business, you know, who takes care of the house, takes care of the kids, whatever. And we're trying to fit ourselves into this mold, and it's tough, and it's impossible to be perfect, and yet we think we have to be. So I don't know, my advice would be, number one, to just let go. And then as, you know, some of the researchers and academics we've talked to would say, realize that good enough really is good enough.
So you kind of reference the kind of problem of workplaces that are designed with the notion that women have somebody at home. There's recent evidence that's come out that shows that in urban areas, at least, college-educated, single women are doing just as well in the workplace as their male peers. But once you get married and have children, that equality drops off. What are your feelings about that particular research?
I think that research is right on. You know, there have been dozens of studies, and we cite a lot of them in the book, that women are perceived, you know, from the get-go as not as serious about their career, because even if they don't have children, there's the idea that someday they will. To the point where, and this is ridiculous, the women are told, hey, don't put pictures of your babies up on the bulletin board, or, you know, if you use the on-site daycare center, you're going to be seen as less serious about your career. Whereas for men, you know, when they put a picture of a new baby up on their wall, everybody thinks, hey, what a guy. And so I kind of lost the track of your question, but I think the workplace is really tough, and I think even single women, maybe career-wise, they're doing okay, but still, they're locked into the system where a 40-hour work week now you know, amounts to 52 hours, and I may still have to go home and commute and what have you. And this whole idea of work-life balance is not leaving much time for a life.
So women are suffering kind of from this choice paralysis and these increasing demands on our time. And I think the media has often chosen to demonize feminism, saying that the problem is giving women choices in the first place. What's your response to that criticism?
My response is to say it's not feminism that's given us, it's not feminism to blame. What it is, if anything, is that feminism still has work to do. You know, we're in the midst of a bunch of growing pains, and I think we're looking to feminists and feminism to help find our way through. You know, I mean, feminism is what gave us the choices, and that's fantastic. And now let's go a step further. Let's see how we deal with those, and let's see how we make changes in the workplace so that men and women, you know, can survive in what's become a very difficult place to maintain any semblance of a life outside of work. And, you know, enter when a family enters and it becomes all the more difficult, especially for women. And I think this is where we need feminists and the whole idea of third wave feminism to step up and help us through it. So I don't think that feminism is to blame at all. I think feminism is our hope.
Well, and that brings me to another interesting point of this. This book was written for women. Mm-hmm. And men also have, the way I'd put it is women are just catching up with men. All these things that are putting demands on women, you know, the workplace, having a lot of choices, having to balance the need to please people and find yourself, having to balance work and family. Men have always had these problems. So why are men not suffering from this unhappiness that is so prevalent in modern women?
I think to a certain extent they are. I think a lot of men are going through this whole idea of analysis paralysis or, grass is greener syndrome. And one reason for that, and there's some studies out there that back this up, is that men are doing more at home and participating more with their families. So they're starting to feel the stresses that women have been feeling for some time. I think there was one study by the Work and Family Institute that said that while women's stress levels have stayed about the same, men's stress levels have risen. So, yes, men are experiencing a lot of this. But here's the difference with women. It's new. For generations and generations and generations, men were raised to know that their role was to go and seek and conquer, to be, you know, to be off slaying the dragon while women were the pretty princesses waiting for them back in the castle. So they have generational role models and societal role models. This is the way they've been socialized. For women, it's new. You know, we have gotten out of the castle, but we're kind of feeling our way. There aren't the role models that say, as one of our sources told us, she went to a prestigious college. She and all her college buddies are doctors and lawyers and PhD candidates. And she was talking about, their most of them by and large were parents as well. And she was talking about the differences in her generation and among her friends. And she was saying that when their mothers came of age, they had three options. They could be a nurse, a secretary, or a teacher. And then these women came of age to know that they could do anything, and they were pursuing their dreams, and they were being applauded, and it was wonderful, and they wouldn't trade a minute of it. But they said what their mothers never taught them and what they never learned was that, for one thing, you know, if you're married and all of a sudden you have an opportunity at the other end of the country, or, you know, in a small state in the middle of the country, nobody prepares you for the fact that you're going to have to, in her words, cowboy up for about 2 weeks of intense conversation with your husband, trying to explain to him why this is beneficial. And she said, oh, the other thing is, women don't want to give up their career, but they don't, you know, they don't feel comfortable leaving their kids in daycare all the time. And again, the other lesson they haven't learned generationally is that if you want to pursue your dreams and your career, you have to let go of baking the perfect pound cake. And I think, I mean, that's what's so different for women. You know, we haven't seen this in action for, you know, 20 or 40 or 50 or 100 years the way men have. And I think that's why this is a book geared for women rather than women and men.
My guest today has been Barbara Kelly, and her book is called Undecided, How to Ditch the Endless Quest for Perfect and Find the Career in Life That's Right for You. You can find it online or at your local bookstore. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Barbara.
Oh, thank you, Amanda. This was a great discussion.
Another month, another famous man accused of sexual assault. This time, it's the head of the IMF, Dominique Strauss-Kahn. Or should I say the former head of the IMF, as he's resigned in the wake of a pretty shocking accusation that he orally raped a hotel maid and was arrested before his plane took off for France. The story was remarkable for a number of reasons, but at the top was how swiftly he was arrested. The alleged assault occurred in the early afternoon, and by late afternoon he was pulled off a plane, put in a lineup, and identified by the accuser. Speculation about how he would defend himself started immediately.
Talking yesterday, and you said the defense would be either that he didn't do it,
yep,
or it was consensual.
Yep.
I guess we know now.
Well, except that the defense sources are telling me that it is likely that they will end up arguing that something happened in that hotel room, but it was not criminal. It was not forced. So while Chris is reporting that the prosecutors are saying, hey, be careful here, mm-hmm, you better not be suggesting this was consent, defense sources are suggesting just that.
It did seem that the attempt to deny that anything happened evaporated within hours of his arrest. Indeed, most of his defenders seem to be suggesting that the main problem here is that Americans are prudes, as if being opposed to harassing, assaulting, and abusing women means you're against sex. In fact, what it means is that you're against violence. I would argue that sex is hotter and more fun all around if it's consensual. There's a tedious predictability to certain responses to all of this. Take, for instance, the usual trumpeting of the wife standing beside the accused.
I do not believe for a single second the accusations leveled against my husband. In 2002, another French journalist claimed she had to fight him off while interviewing him for a book she was writing. And in 2008, he admitted to having an affair with a subordinate working for him at the IMF.
We knew that he was someone probably not completely faithful to his wife.
The stuff about his affairs is a little disturbing because the question isn't whether or not he's accused of being a cheater. Since his wife famously doesn't seem to mind that he's a cheater, I think that's basically none of our business, since they basically have an open marriage. The question is whether or not he's the kind of man who foists himself on unwilling women. And that is a much more troubling question, and the testimony of this other journalist who says he tried to attack her needs to be looked at in light of these new accusations. What concerns me is that no matter how plausible or credible an accusation is, the same old narratives are being used to minimize it. It was sex and not rape. His wife supports him. This is all a conspiracy put together by his enemies to bring him down. On the last one, well, unfortunately, it's gaining steam, aided in part by similar claims made about Julian Assange. The good news, however, is that the comedians are beginning to get tired of this predictable cycle. And some real humor has come out of all this. Jon Stewart had some fun with the way that Strauss-Kahn's defenders don't believe that innocent until proven guilty applies to the accuser, who is assumed without evidence to be lying. His best target was Ben Stein, who swore that the accuser must be lying.
Stein writes, prosecutors say that Mr. Strauss-Kahn forced the complainant to have oral and other sex with him. How? Did he have a gun? Did he have a knife? He's a short, fat, old man.
Yes, he's not nearly in the kind of raping shape he used to be in. I mean, 15 years ago, this guy was a raping machine.
And Saturday Night Live had a skit showing Strauss-Kahn listening to two fellow inmates at Rikers who are knowledgeable about European economics ask him questions about the IMF policy.
The Germans are the only people in Europe that know the score right now.
What about Sweden?
I meant countries in the Eurozone.
Well, you didn't say that.
We're talking about the Euro, so leave Sweden out of it.
Well, when it comes to the Euro, Sweden thanks God every day that they was left out of it. You know what I'm talking about? Come on, man. You know what I'm talking about? That's right. Yeah, Nick likes that one. See, he's smiling a little bit. He's in jail, but he's smiling.
Yeah. All I'm saying is the Germans are proving that the only way out of a debt crisis is austerity measures. You get in the jam, you got to cut back.
The skit ended, kind of predictably, with the prisoners threatening to rape Strauss-Kahn. The joke fell flat, in my opinion, but I do think they were trying in a way to remind the audience of what Strauss-Kahn is accused of, to bring it home. While that joke didn't work for me, I am glad to see more comedy shows take on the issues of rape and power dynamics, at least in this way, where rape is held out as something bad and people who defend it as real douchebags. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, dramatically missing the point edition. Granted, it's Rush Limbaugh's job to miss the point dramatically, so this isn't a surprise.
Sarah Palin is attacked as if she were a baby killer. But of course, the fact that she isn't a baby killer is one of the things that drives them crazy about her. They wanted her to kill her baby, but she didn't. She had it. It makes her an enemy.
Needless to say, the notion that there's a they out there who kills babies and wants others to do it is just a lie. But we all know that he means abortion when he says baby killer. And even then, he's just lying. Not to be glib about it, but pro-choicers are pro-choice. We don't care if Palin chose to have a baby. What bothers us is that she wants to take the choice away from everyone else.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.